Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music, Dave.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, baby.
No, what's in the box?
I said you give me the
what's
gun.
In the box?
Give me the gun.
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, then they'll come after us. How can we tell if we're close? We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Your son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
They're insane.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
Do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well, for now.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone. This is Abe.
Abe, how are you?
Not bad. Not bad at all.
Excellent. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I'm really good.
Excellent. I wish we were all in Maine, because Maine is one of the five states that still doesn't have a coronavirus.
Knock on wood.
No, but Maine has fucking clowns in the fucking sewer, so no, we're not going to Maine.
Yes, but the clowns in the sewer say they have hand sanitizer, so...
Oh, goodness. Yeah. You know what?
And I'll toilet paper!
I'll give the horror community credit. They're very good at making memes.
They really are.
I saw two today in particular that really made me laugh. One was somebody modified the poster for Children of the Corn to be Children of the Coronavirus, and they all had masks and hand sanitizer. I saw another one that was a picture of Leatherface, and it said, "You don't have to worry about touching your face if you're wearing somebody else's."
That's good.
That's awesome.
Now, hopefully, in 365 days from now, we're still laughing at this, but or that we're even still here. So,
oh come on, Phil.
You're freaking out, Phil.
Yeah, know, I think it's like people are hoarding the toilet paper. There's some and hoarding the hand sanitizer. Somebody was selling the hand sanitizer online for. Like $95 for a bottle of hand sanitizer.
Well, as washing your hands.
No, it does not. But I'm saying there's some people who are just disgustingly trying to profit off of
misery.
Off of this disease, and I think that's really kind of sad. But while we're talking about disease, if you would like to listen to our Dark Discussions episode about the movie Contagion, then you can go to the website darkdiscussions.com and download episode. I think it's episode 66.
Did we do one on Contagion?
Well, it was just me and Mike that weekend.
Oh, okay.
You couldn't make it.
Oh, wait, hold on. It's episode 37. We talk about Andromeda Strain, Cabin Fever. And Contagion was the main one, and there were others that were in there.
I remember now, yeah.
So if you want to do that and go give us some more hits, that would be awesome.
And go watch Contagion. Freak yourself the fuck out. It'd
exactly.
Be awesome.
This is a perfect... I do laugh, right? I'm seeing people on the horror pages going, anyone got some disease-related movies you're willing to recommend?
It comes at night.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess it is. Obviously, The Thing.
Yep.
28 days later.
I think Contagion was one of the scariest ones that I saw, though. I saw that years ago, and I refuse to watch it now because I know it's just going to...
Oh, I've already watched it 4 times this week.
Oh,
after watching it at the theaters years ago.
That's awesome.
I watched it like we're wondering why you're freaking out.
It comes at night. I'm watching that one now, too.
The worm.
Self-care, Phil. You need to practice self-care.
The worm.
Well, I am going, when I do activities now, going forward, it's just me and the family or the dog in the woods, and that's it. There's no people in the woods. So.
That's what you think.
Just the bears.
The wrong turn.
The bears have coronavirus.
Anyway, all right. So either way, who we are for new listeners, if you haven't about to hung up on us yet because of our silliness, we are Dark Discussions Podcast, where we discuss and critique various genre films. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, cult films, midnight movies, and things of that nature. As I stated, we do critique and review, not just one or the other. And we basically try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We do have a Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where you can join us and discuss topics related to genre. So there's stuff about the Black Widow film, A Quiet Place 2, James Bond films, or a lot of big discussions going on there. You can either join in the conversations or start your own. So if you are interested in the death of Max von Sydow and what's your favorite film, you can start a conversation there and people can go and start talking all about his films and things of that nature. We also have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where we will read your email on the podcast. So if you have critiques, reviews, topics you'd like us to talk about, a film that you saw that you want to let folks know about, anything like that, send it to us at darkdiscussions@aol.com and we will read it on the podcast. We do have a website, and Eric, what is that website?
Well, Phil, that website is www.darkdiscussions.com. If you go there, you'll find a whole bunch of stuff. On the right-hand side of the front page, you'll find links to friends of the podcast, so you can check all them out. At the top of the page, you'll find links to different sections of the site, including an articles section, where there's some articles written by myself as well as others, and an audio section where you'll find every single episode that's ever been recorded of Dark Discussions, as well as any of the spinoff podcasts that we do available for free. There's bound to be something there that interests you, so check it out. Front and center on the front page of darkdiscussions.com, you'll find a link to the Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially support your online artists. Producing this show is not free. We have to pay for things like watching movies and server storage and new equipment and so on and so forth. So if you'd like to help offset the cost of doing all that, you can go follow that link on the front page, or you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all the submissions from our patrons, and on a quarterly basis, we draw them at random. So we do a show based on a topic chosen by one of our patrons. So you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Yep, excellent. Very well, very well. Mike, there's a new podcast that's our third season of the podcast is coming up this week.
Yes, Bulge Brothels and Bots, which is a podcast dedicated to the HBO TV series Westworld, based on the Michael Crichton film, 1969 film, 1970 film, 68?
74 or 76.
74, 1974 yeah. Film Westworld. I was thinking that was Futureworld, but 1974 film Westworld, which inspired the TV series, which is by not Christopher Nolan, but Christopher Nolan's brother. Jonathan Nolan, and produced by J.J. Abrams, so lens flares galore. It is a really solid science fiction series. It is definitely – I read an early review of it, and the early review was glowing, said it is still hyper-violent. There really isn't a lot that you have – because if you've been watching the show, there's a very clean break in the end of the second season to lead to a new development in the story. So it seems like it could be a really good jumping on point if you've never watched the show before. But if you haven't watched the show before and you do plan on it, if you have a chance, I do strongly recommend that you watch the first two seasons because they are, I think, really good.
That's right. And a couple of people are joining the cast, Vincent Cassell and also the French actor and the guy that used to play Jesse on Breaking Bad. What's that guy's name?
Aaron Paul.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Also, it'll be curious to see if Elon Musk's ex will return. She was the blonde woman that blew herself up at the end of season two. So I'm curious if she'll return because they can transfer brains and all that stuff. So, but either way, that's cool. Yep. So people should check that out on the Dark Discussions podcast feed, as well as Bullets, Brothels, and Bots of Westworld podcast feed. And then there's one passing, as I noted, Max von Sydow passed, has done a number of genre films, and probably most famous in the English language world for The Exorcist. He was, I have no idea how old he was, but he was very old.
Like 90?
Yeah,
million,
something like that.
873?
Yeah, yeah. So, so what's he, one, two, three of the five leads of Dead from that movie now, and then also six, if you, or the fourth one if you want to include the director, the Irish director in, that played the actor that directed Ellen Spurge. So, yeah, a lot of people pass it from that film.
It is, in fairness, a film that is about 46 years old, and it was not a film with children in it, except for one. So, yeah, they're old. They're old now.
Yeah, yeah, and that child is older than us, or about the same age as us, as a matter of fact.
I did laugh. Somebody, because you have to keep your sense of humor over dark things, I don't remember. I wish I could remember who the news outlet was or the website that did it. That Star Wars actor Max von Sydow died today. It's like, because Max von Sydow had about a 30-second clip at the beginning of The Force Awakens that almost everyone forgets about.
Yeah, I remember that.
So they referred to him as a Star Wars actor.
Yeah, it's kind of, so it's like saying Christopher Lee a Star Wars actor or something, when they should be focusing on the more
everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a Nazi murderer.
Which one was that?
That was Christopher Lee.
What movie was that?
That was real life. He murdered Nazis.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was a war hero. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That is correct.
And by which I want to point out, no, not like your grandpa was in the, you know, was on D-Day and shot randomly and happened to wing a couple of Nazis. He murdered Nazis. That was his job. You know, he hunted and murdered Nazis. I am amazed that they have not made his life into a story.
Right, right. Yeah, and Ted Williams and Bob Fellow dropped bombs on the Japanese and Germans.
Mm-hmm.
As fighter pilots. But you're right, that would be an excellent movie, to be honest, for Christopher Lee's life.
The guy who had to explain to, who was it? I think it was trying to explain to Peter Jackson what it sounds like when you stab a man.
Right.
And you can hear the blood gurgling.
And he's actually half noble, because his mother's family were Italian noble people, and they left Italy and they settled in the UK, while his father's side was just humble beginnings, which are Anglos. Tallulah Riley, that's the woman that was in Westworld.
I lost track of what we're even talking about.
We were supposed to be talking about
Max von Sydow,
but we had a
digression to Christopher Lee.
Yeah,
he circled all the way back to Westworld. Got it.
Yeah, something like that.
Hey, well, still, we have to go back to the hot chicks.
Oh, for God. All right, so I think we can get into our topic tonight.
So, with all that cheery news.
Yes, we can talk about a movie tonight. And, Eric, what is that topic we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be discussing a relatively new release that's on video on demand. I think it was in theaters for a short time, limited release. It is a Nicolas Cage vehicle based on an H.P. Lovecraft short story, Color Out of Space.
Dun, dun, dun.
Look at this.
All those years in the big city, we finally got out. We're living the dream.
Maybe it is a dream.
Then everything just blew up. Big flash, like a pink light. Or actually, I don't even know what color it was. It wasn't like any color I'd ever seen before.
It looks like a meteorite.
You mean it's radioactive? I mean, it's from space, right?
Meteorites are generally no more dangerous than ordinary rocks.
How can something that big just disappear? Did you plant those?
No.
Ward, come here for a sec.
Oh, God.
What are you doing?
Shh. It's talking to me.
Who's talking to you?
A man in the well.
It's in the static. It's in the moisture. It's in here. It's out there. And what's out there is in here now.
Everything's under control.
Why are you so in denial? That thing from the meteorite changes everything around it.
It's just a color. No! But it burns.
Can you believe me now?
I don't know what I believe anymore. Everything's going to be A-okay.
That's right. Color Out of Space. For going some details for those who are interested, we're recording this on March 12th, 2020. The Color Out of Space is, as Eric mentioned, based off or is a short story by H.P. Lovecraft. This is a reimagining or updated version of the story. Directed by Richard Stanley, best known for Hardware, whose career was on the high end, and then it got sidetracked because of a disaster by many producers for The Isle of Dr. Moreau, the film with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer. And so he pretty much quit or was forced to quit at Blacklist, who knows what happened, and kind of faded away for a while. Even though he was supposed to be the next big thing. He's still only 52 or so, so it still could happen. This film is produced by Elijah Wood, who actually was the one that went to get Richard Stanley out of retirement to direct a film. Richard Stanley is a South African who now settles and lives in the great country of France. The screenplay is by Richard Stanley and a woman named Scarlett Armaris. The film, as Eric mentioned, stars Nicolas Cage, but it also stars Vanessa Redgrave's daughter, Julie Richardson, probably best known for Event Horizon, maybe, among other films. And then some other lesser-known actors are in it as well because they're younger, such as Madeline Arthur and Brendan Mayer and Julian Hillard, who play the three kids. And then Tommy Chong has an important role as well. And then the narrator, Ward Phillips, is played by Elliot Knight. And there's a couple other minor characters, but nothing of importance. The film takes place in Massachusetts, was filmed in Portugal, just outside of Lisbon, because I guess Portugal now is becoming similar to Hungary and Bulgaria and stuff, where they're giving major tax credits. The film has received excellent reviews. Basically it is, around 70 something percent on Rotten Tomatoes and, 86%, which is even better. And that's out of 152 reviews and by major publications, not just bloggers. And as, Eric said, it was, short, directly at the theaters. And I know, Mike, you saw it, so you can give us your experience of that film at theaters. It was actually around where me and Abe live, but I didn't get to see it. It was during a weekend that I was swamped. Budget was only $12 million, which some may say was pretty small for what was impressive on the screen, but we'll get into all that. So let's get around and discuss how we heard about the film and what we thought about it. And so, Mike, let's start with you, since you actually got to see it at the theaters.
Yeah, I did. I'm pretty sure Chrissy did, too. So they did, was it Fathom Events? I think Fathom Events did it as a Fathom Event kind of thing, as a special screening. And thankfully, I arrived early because as a special screening in an AMC theater, there were no trailers, and it was funny because about 30 minutes into the film, people walked into the theater.
That's awesome. I know I would have showed up like an hour late, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, because you still won't believe me. That's not an hour long. Yeah, so it's the film is I really like the film. I haven't read the story in a long, long time. I don't really remember much about it. I have seen the original adaptation with Boris Karloff. I was not all that impressed with.
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty good film. I got that on Blu-ray.
But I liked this movie a lot. And right now it is really close to my favorite film this year on a relatively short list. Admittedly, you know, because it's not going to be, I don't know, what was the... I can't remember what the names of the other films are we saw, but
VFW Underwater, The Invisible Man.
Yeah, Invisible Man is the only one that comes close to it for me, and I might on a different day pick Invisible Man, but this one just speaks a little bit more to where I like to go, which is sort of this creepy cosmic horror. It depending on your definition, it has some monsters in it, and has really one of the. You know, when the year end of the words things is most disturbing often, and this has got a really disturbing concept in it. There are some wonderful Nick Cage moments.
Yes, indeed.
There are some good practical effects work in here. Good use of CGI to give us that color out of space, a color that no man has ever seen before, also known as magenta. Yeah, I just strongly recommend it if you are a fan of Lovecrafty-type films. And this is our second real, true Lovecraft film that we had this year, the other one being Underwater. And then you have movies like Endless that came out 2 years ago. Maybe there's a resurgence of Lovecrafty-type movies, and Stanley has said he has two more films he wants to do, which is Dexter Ward?
The Dunwich Horror was the next one.
And Dunwich Horror, right. So, yeah, I strongly recommend it. I enjoyed seeing it in the theaters, and also when I saw it in theaters, there was a little Q&A afterwards. You know, I don't know. I don't know if it was ever live, but it was like in L.A., and so there was a question and answer with Nick Cage and with Richard Stanley, which was nice and informative. And Rick Cage was like decked out in weird leather outfit. I don't know because he's Nick Cage, and so he has to spend his money on stupid shit. So.
Well, he was Silver Spoon, even if he made his own money, because he is a Coppola.
He made it, and then gave it all to the IRS.
That is true. All right, sounds good. All right, so I'll go next. I heard about it through our 2020 preview thing or something, and it was kind of getting the rounds of Richard Stanley's comeback and various other things. I think it was a pretty solid film. At first, I was very concerned that it was not going to be good. The music at the beginning was kind of Steven Spielberg-y, and it's like, what the heck's going on here, and whatever. But then it starts really ramping up, and it becomes a really, really good, solid horror film. Excellent combination of CGI and standard effects, animatronics and whatnot, so really good there. Nicolas Cage is Nicolas Cage, but he was solid enough, pretty good. Actually, I think the best actor was the girl that played Lavanya. She was pretty solid as someone that's kind of new to cinema. But all in all, they were all really good. The story, I remember the Lovecraft story when I read it. It was one of my favorite Lovecraft stories. Again, I haven't read it for a while, so there won't be many in the book. But I do know there was a lot to do with the well, and that does take place in this film here. I can see this as a top 10 horror film at the end of the year, most likely. I don't know if it's better than VFW or The Invisible Man, because I think those two films are still my favorite films, but it's still definitely a potential top 10. Yeah, it's a big thumbs up. Abe?
So I heard you about this film for a while. I never wasn't sure when we would get around to doing so, so I was pleasantly surprised when it was going to be this week's topic. I watched it just today after I got back from work, and I really did like this movie. I always enjoy Lovecraft stories, or stories that adapt or kind of take imaginative twists with his storylines. And there's a lot to like in here. There's really weird, grotesque body horror. There's some beautiful sceneries that are both haunting and bizarre. Colin Stetson, who is best known for his music in Hereditary, does a really good job of creating, composing the soundtrack for this film. I also really enjoy the performances. Even Nicolas Cage, when he's just hamming it up. Some people might be put off by it because his hamminess might kind of clash with everything, but I've always enjoyed him, even when he's at his goofiest. There is some really cool creatures. One of them kind of giving nice callbacks to the kennel creature from The Thing. It's just overall really well made film. And it's going to be fun to talk about it. I never really read the original story it was based off of. So I don't really have much knowledge on that. But I am now curious to kind of see what the source material itself is like. I'm not sure where it's going to place at the end of the year, but overall, it was a nice, refreshing film for this year, since it's been kind of slow. And looking forward to talking about it.
All right. Eric?
I heard about this movie because it was getting quite a bit of buzz on social media. Anybody who's listened to this podcast for a while knows I have issues with Nick Cage, mainly being that I just want to punch him in the face.
You have a pillow. You can do that.
No, Dan has the pillow. I don't want that in my house. but yeah. So this was a good movie. There were moments like my only issues with this movie are the moments when like Mike described this as wonderful Nick Cage moments. I feel the opposite. There are places where going full Cage is appropriate, like the movie Mom and Dad. Okay, that's a place for it. Bad Lieutenant, that's another place for it. I didn't feel that it belonged in this movie, so that really kind of took me out of it, those moments when he went full Cage. And I was so disappointed, too, because at the beginning of the movie, he was actually doing a good job. But that was really my only issue with the movie. Other than that, I thought the acting was great, the effects were great, and this movie, more than any other I can remember, left me with the sensation that I have after I read a Lovecraft story, which is just like, well, that was weird. but it's the same type of feeling I get after reading the Lovecraft story. So I've never actually read this one, but it definitely had a Lovecraft feel for me personally. I do recommend the movie, and I have a feeling that people that have less problems with Nick Cage than I do will like it even more.
Chrissy?
I, too, got the chance to see this in the theater. I saw it at Acoustic Java, which is the old cable car in downtown Providence, a week after it opened. And it was Acoustic Java is interesting because it's not really what I would consider a real, like, movie theater. I mean, literally, they just have some plastic chairs and a big screen on the wall. But it is a charming place, and it was a really fun place to watch it, because the second they said, oh, the weather guy was like, oh, no, I'm from Providence. The whole tiny audience, there were like 30 of us, were like, yay. So that was kind of fun. And I got it on Blu-ray as soon as it came out, and I was really disappointed there wasn't a commentary. I'd watched a documentary a while back about Lovecraft, which I'll share where listeners can find it later, because it is available and it's free online. And one of the things they'd said was that The Color Out of Space would make a great movie, but it would be impossible to show the color. So my first thing, first of all, I really loved this film overall. I was impressed at how Stanley handled the color, in that he really didn't worry about it too much. He kind of showed what he felt he should show, and he just filled in more details about the actual color with statements from the characters, so that the audience maybe gets the feeling that they're not seeing the actual color. I was very impressed with the special effects. I was very impressed with how the creatures of, from, you know, the special effect creatures were handled, and that you saw just enough so that it didn't look cheesy, and it was very disturbing. An excellent job was done adapting the original story. I think it keeps this film, keeps the spirit of the original. And if you've read the story, then you would know that it really is about the same tale. All they did was kind of flesh it out with some additional storylines, such as, you know, Lavinia, the girl is a witch. There's a bit of a love story. The mother's just recovered from cancer. They're a loving couple. There's all these different things that he added. And if you've read the original story is a lot like a journal entry. It is like many of Lovecraft's tales told in this sort of, yes, it's a recounting. It's almost like an epistolary form. So I think the scriptwriters, Stanley in particular, had a big job here, because he kind of had to flesh out these people. What were these people like? I think that I understand what Eric is saying about Full Cage. There were a couple of places where I was just like, ugh, not great. However, the way that he is depicted and the way that he, which I'll talk about later, loses his mind and stuff, while it seemed a little extreme, it absolutely does echo exactly the way that Nahum is described in the story, the way that he kind of goes nuts. And so I'm thinking that some of that Full Cage badness might have actually been intentional. I did go in with low expectations, but I love Richard Stanley, and I wasn't disappointed. This story in itself, it does have some of Poe's influence. I am not sure when in his career Lovecraft wrote this, but I do know that there was a period where he was sort of doing a lot of Poe-inspired stuff, and I don't know if this fell into that because of the way it's really about being driven to madness. And some of his work that deals with that particular subject, that was the time in his life when he was writing, when he was very influenced by Poe. I liked this movie. I thought the script was tight. I thought Cage was decent, especially at the beginning. I think I said pretty much everything I liked. I thought there were some genuinely creepy moments that were just wonderfully done. Aside from that, this movie was incredibly emotionally triggering for me, in one particular part of it. And there's a very specific reason why. So I was enjoying the film and getting into it, and then I got emotionally triggered, which made me really fall hard in love with this movie. So I felt the same way I did after I came out of Hereditary. And I literally, the friend that was with me, literally, I couldn't talk. I just was like I had to be led to the car, and it's like, all right, we need to get you to a bar because you are not talking and this is scaring me. So yeah, because he'd never seen me behave like that before. So yeah, so I, right now, this is my number one movie of the year, but of course that could change. So sorry I took a long time to go through all that, but well, I really, really did appreciate this film.
It might not, because all the movies are being canceled.
This, yeah, that's true. This could be all we have this year. This and Underwater. This and Underwater. That's it. Those are our choices, guys. This and Underwater. And VFW, right? Isn't VFW this year, too?
Yeah, and Invisible
Man. So those are our three choices.
And
Invisible Man. Yeah. All right, so four movies.
Fantasy Island.
And five. Oh, yeah. Okay,
four
so
movies.
Here's our five. Here's our five movies.
Five.
Just put them in order of what you think is best, because the rest of them are canceled.
But other than those five things, what movies have the Romans ever made for us?
So I am really looking forward to talking about this movie, because, like I said, I have read this story actually several times. Hands down, it is my favorite by Lovecraft, and I am, unlike a lot of people, I am a relative newbie to appreciating Lovecraft. I never really appreciated him before, and then I went to Necronomicon, and I kind of got exposed to some different ideas and went to a few lectures, and I was like, oh, I think I may have missed the boat on some of this, and I really need to start exploring this. Yeah, and I'm actually kind of working on a few Lovecraftian-inspired tales myself, which is something I never would have thought I ever would have done. So it was very exciting to see this movie.
I do have specific questions for you later, Christy.
Okay, absolutely, yeah. Go ahead,
Christy, Phil. Where was this theater exactly? What town? Is it in Providence?
Yes, it's Acoustic Java, downtown Providence. It's where the old cable car used to be. I forget the name of the street, but it is down by the river. Like, you can see the river where they have water fire nearby. So it's on, like, the lower hill. No, it's not. I don't know why they called it the cable car. It was probably some shitty dive bar. I don't remember, because I did not spend a lot of time in Providence up until about a year and a half ago, and prior to that, the only time I'd been there was in college, when it was, I mean, water fire wasn't even there. It's a completely different city from when I went to school there 25 years ago. So it was a real shithole when I went to college there in the early 90s. It was bad. Now it's really become quite a nice city, and a lot of these older things that I have discovered from friends who have kind of lived there have said, oh yeah, that used to be a shithole. Now it's this beautiful little thing, and they're doing something new with it. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's a pretty nice city now. Absolutely. It's definitely,
yeah, it is beautiful now. Very beautiful. Yeah.
All right. So, that's our, how we heard about the film and what we thought about it. Seems like all of us, thought it was a pretty good film. So we're pretty much on the page with most reviewers and a good percentage of people in the horror groups on social media. So before we continue, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki.
All right. A secluded farm is struck by a strange meteorite, which has apocalyptic consequences for the family living there and possibly the world.
All right. Interesting. That wasn't in the story, and it didn't seem like it was in this, but because it seemed more like a region, not even a regional, just a 100-yard area, but
well,
whatever.
It says possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm actually more stuck the other way. Can you have a family apocalypse? Apocalypse seems like a really...
I mean,
it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a genocide of one, you know. No, you're using the term wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely, but they said in the world, but it was like, I don't know, even in the short
They also said apocalyptic, so they didn't actually say apocalypse.
Yeah, right. They're still alluding to apocalypse. I'm just...
Okay. It's kind of interesting.
You're just nitpicking, as you always do.
Well, that's true, but also... But again, though, this is just a wiki, and these little marketing.
We're not here to critique the wiki.
That is correct.
Can we critique the person reading the wiki?
All right, I'm out.
I thought you did quite well, Eric. I had no issues with it. All right, so we're going to talk about the film, but before we get into spoilers, because we're going to critique besides review, so we just did the review part, general stuff about the story, the Richard Stanley coming back, special effects, things that don't spoil the film. Anybody have anything they wanted to talk about prior to spoiling?
It's a Lovecraft film, right? So the color represented the Jews, right? Was that the issue? Am I understanding
what?
That?
I'm sorry?
Lovecraft has been criticized a lot online for his anti-Semitism.
Oh.
He was married to a Jewish woman, though. So.
Yeah, well.
He did marry a Jewish woman. Well, and, you know, it's interesting to note, too, with Lovecraft, though, because there has been a lot of talk over the years about his racism and his xenophobia. I mean, he was really quite extreme. There's one story he wrote. Oh gosh.
Oh, the old man. Where there's a Portuguese, an Italian, and a Polish, and they were all criminals.
Yeah. He was really
When I read that, I had to show my mother. I go, look, man, it's great.
He was really against the immigration at the time. And he really was. He really didn't want these people coming in and, quote, destroying his world. Now, if you watch.
He's an old wasp. What do you expect from those people?
Yeah, if you watch this documentary that I'm going to give you guys reference information for later, the thing is, like, even Guillermo del Toro and some of these other academics that are interviewed on this, and we got some heavy hitters on there.
He was a man of his times. What are you going to
expect? Even Guillermo del Toro says he is a product of his time. And it's really a reflection on what was going on at the time. And while he may have been a little bit more xenophobic than others because of his particular background and because of the way he was raised, still, I mean, he was really not that much worse than others of his time. The difference being that he was very much a little more blatant about it. And he did have certain friends that he would have long discourses with through letters and just these long rants about the immigrants are ruining everything and blah, blah, blah. And you can see it in his stories.
They took our yards.
And this is why Eric will always be safe.
The cat's name and the rat on the walls. It's like, oh my right. gosh.
But
I can't even say the word.
So this is why Eric will always be safe, because he just hates everybody and that will stand the test of time.
That's right.
But it is funny to say he was only a little bit more racist than everybody at the time. Look, in the end, you know, there's always a debate over whether you can separate the artist from their art. And there are some people out there who are fucking bug shit crazy. And that doesn't mean I can't enjoy what they make. And when it's, and I guess when that.
Well, he hated the white people too. He's just like wasps.
I'm just saying. So when he's, well, but also back then though, then they wouldn't have been considered white. If you weren't wasp, you weren't white. You know, I'm Irish and Italian, and they'd be damned if they would have thought my grandparents were white.
Mike.
Absolutely. You know, it has nothing to do with the fact that my grandfather was offered an opportunity to take part in a particular family organization. Look, he's dead. You're not going out supporting a person who is a racist now who makes great art. You're talking about going out and supporting a person who can't possibly in any way profit from it.
Yeah.
Right? And his stories, they're still damn good. And if his stories were – and if being paranoid and racist made him write some pretty freaking awesome stories about aliens evading and paranoia – I don't know anybody who's looking yet. I don't know. I mean, I admittedly haven't really watched the Libertarian Convention, but I don't know anyone who's saying that we should be banning immigrants because they're going to bring back the great old ones.
There's sadly this kind of thing going on where anyone who's done anything in the past or any point in history, regardless of what they created, regardless of what they contribute, there's this kind of mentality, this kind of culture trying to erase, trying to brush away these kind of things because even they had some ideas or they had by person, every single, you know, not every single person that has contributed something in our world, one way or the other, whether it's arts, film, music, was a complete saint. And there's this kind of reset culture that's trying to get rid of all this stuff just because the person who created it might have been a bad person or may have a few things they disagreed with.
Or it was a product of their time, right?
I don't know if they're trying to get rid of it. They're just trying to bring to light that, yeah, this guy was also a
shit. There are people.
Yeah, there are those.
There are people who actually want them to get rid of those things just because the person who created them has some bad ideas.
But they should go to a different country where free speech isn't the right.
Yeah, but Tom Hanks is a saint, so I don't think I completely agree with Abe's statement.
Wow.
What?
But I'm telling you, the old man, dude, you got to read that story. It's only a 3-page story, and the three bad guys are immigrants from Poland, Portugal, and Italy. I was just
in tears. Why are you laughing so hard? I don't
know. Well, because I'm half Portuguese, so I was like laughing my ass off when I read this story.
Now, if one of the guys had asked the others for a blowjob, then he really would have lost.
Everybody in my town, you know, my neighborhood is either Italian, Polish, or Portuguese, so it's like we're all bad people. It was just funny to read.
Bill, he has a story, what is it, about Red Hook, the monster of Red Hook?
Yeah, that's another good one.
That's the story where the horror at Red Hook.
Right, that's it.
Horror at Red Hook. And I believe that's the one that most of the academics agree that you can really see his xenophobia. Like, you can really see it. Like, well, it is super obvious.
Don't forget the cat and rats in the wall, though. Yeah, the name of the cat.
The thing I like about Lovecraft is he always describes things in a way that they aren't described. He's like a color that had never been seen by man before. All right, so what did it fucking look like?
Or
one of the great old ones. You cannot gaze upon this creature, or you would go insane. Well, fine. So fucking what did it look like?
Yeah, he doesn't explain it. Yeah,
that's what makes him interesting too. Is that Eric? In some of his earlier stories, he really did leave a lot to the imagination, which at the time we have to remember when he was writing, this was a very fertile time for things like magazines and, you know, things like, I believe it's Amazing Stories or wherever it was he sold most of his work. You know, these speculative things, there was a hunger for it in the population. And so people wanted, you know, people would use their imaginations and he let them. However, as he got toward the end of his life and he started writing more and more, and started to come into his own voice, which took a very long time for him to develop. You know, he was sort of copying Poe for a while. He was copying some other people for a while. Finally, he comes into his own voice. And that is when, in those later stories, he starts actually using descriptions like, you know, it's a sea cucumber with speckles on it or whatever. In some of those later pieces. But I think that's what makes The Color Out of Space and some of his earlier works interesting. Because, like, particularly in Color Out of Space, the reason I like this story is because the descriptions in this are vague, like you say, Eric, but they're less sensationalized than it was the scariest thing you've ever seen, like you were saying, because I know exactly what you're talking about, and that's totally laughable. Like, I'm just like, whatever, dude. I mean, there are some really creepy descriptions in here. Like, he talks about the boys go out and find this woodchuck. This, and basically all he says about this woodchuck I will find it, actually, and I'll read it exactly to you, but not right now. But he says something, because I got to find it. But he says something like, oh, here we go. In February, the McGregor boys from Meadow Hill were out shooting woodchucks, and not far from the Gardner place bagged a very peculiar specimen. The proportions of its body seemed slightly altered in a queer way, impossible to describe, while its face had taken on an expression which no one had ever seen in a woodchuck before. The boys were genuinely frightened and threw the thing away at once, so that only their grotesque tales of it ever reached the people of the countryside. And there's something about that description that it, even though he says nothing, you're sitting there going, oh my God, like, what does its face look like? And the language is very harsh. Like, they threw the thing away at once.
I know
its body were, you know, it's like, it's the language that he uses too that almost suggests kind of what it looks like. Sorry, Mike, go ahead.
No, I know people, who have criticized Lovecraft for this.
Yeah.
And I was first reading Lovecraft in college. And I loved this. I loved the way he could describe something without describing it. I could still get a sense of what was happening on the page. I was never lost. I was never, you know, confused. You know, and certainly he does. I have no idea the chronology of the things he wrote and where they were. And, you know, I know he does do descriptions of things like Cthulhu and, you know, the fish people and was it Dagon or, you know, so he does sometimes give descriptions, but also the idea is to give that sense of dread. And that's what's the purpose of the story. And the purpose of the story, of a scary story, is to leave you scared, unsettled, disturbed. And he describes these things in a way that if he said, you know, this was a 6-foot-tall lizard with a forked tongue and blue eyes, it's just not going to do it. You know, there is, again, leaving things to the imagination. But the idea of color out of space, the idea of a color that you can't describe, this is kind of touching on human limits, you know, something that goes beyond the limits of human experience. And, well, if there is a color that, I mean, it's like asking someone to explain the flavor of chocolate. Our language is terrible, at least the English language, is terrible at describing a flavor or an odor necessarily. You know, but we're generally okay at describing a color, but what happens if you have a color no one's ever seen before? Well, our language fails, and that just continues to enhance the otherness of it. And I agree with you, Chrissy. The concern is how do you do that in a movie? And you can't, because you have to show the color you can't see. And they do use, I don't know, was it magenta, mauve, something like that?
Pink. It was magenta.
Pink. But
there was also a lot of white too, which is interesting because white is actually the presence of all color. So it almost suggests that because like I said, the characters on occasion, I think it's twice. Nicolas Cage says it at one point. He says something like, it was like the color like I've never seen, which is actually in the story. And by the way, there's a lot of stuff that was lifted right out of the story, too, language-wise.
There's even, like, little references to other stories and stuff, like in the background and little things here and there. If you pay attention, like Easter eggs.
Right, like there's a Necronomicon in there, and obviously he's where the geologist is wearing a Miskatonic, or hydrologist, rather, is wearing a Miskatonic University shirt.
Oh, yeah. There's a few other things there, too. I mean, Nathan was watching this with me on the Blu-ray the other night because we rewatched it. But also what's interesting is that there's, you know, when she's sitting there doing – Providence, of course, is mentioned. But when she's doing her ritual, she carves the Lovecraftian pentagram on her chest.
Yes. Yes, she does.
You know, there's – and the ice cubes. Now, this thing is layered. If you really watch this film – very closely, there is Lovecraft symbolism all over this. The ice cubes in Nicolas Cage's glass, and Nathan actually spotted this. I didn't. He said, "Oh my God, did you see that?" And I said, "What?" And he goes, "Dude, look, there's flakes of the color
right
in the ice."
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Yes. However, the flakes, which is what Nathan pointed out because he knows Lovecraft a little better than I do, the flakes are actually in the shape of the elder symbol, Lovecraft's elder symbol, if you look. And sure enough, he paused it, and I was like, oh, holy crap.
And I have a symbolism question for you. I don't know if I should ask it an hour later.
No, because might as well ask now.
Well, I made a comment while I watched this movie with my friends Dan and Susie, and about halfway through the movie, I just said, oh, wow, there's like a triangle motif going on,
yes,
in this movie. I wonder if it means anything. And Dan goes, I noticed the same thing. So is that like a symbolism thing?
Yes, it is. The triangle is very, very obvious. I mean, we see it in the girl's hair in the beginning.
Yeah.
She has a barrette. Then we see it in the window. But it's everywhere. I mean, it's in other places.
Patterns
everywhere.
Of the lights.
The patterns, everything.
The pattern that's showing on the television.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yep.
It's basically almost like kind of shows the complexity of the cosmic presence, just how hard, completely alien and unfathomable it is to the characters.
Right.
Because we never get a direct explanation. You know, we only get like a recording from the hermit that lives outside from what he observed. But even he's left in the dark of what is happening. Mm-hmm. And so these symbols and all these strange things happening are to show how overwhelming trying to process these elders' powers are. Because that's what happens in each story, is that every time someone tries to delve into it, conquer it, or understand it, they are completely either driven insane, or somebody... They go mad, or they're destroyed. it shows how hard... unharnessable the power of these beings are.
Well, and the other thing too with the triangle, Eric, is that there is a Lovecraftian triangle symbol. You know, and my husband laughs because Nathan is very well studied in all different kinds of religions and symbols, and he always laughs. Like last night or Tuesday night, we're watching a movie. He just laughs and he goes, "Oh yeah, the Lovecraft fake witch Necronomicon type symbolism. It's just so blatantly, obviously fake. Like if you've studied any of this esoteric crap, you look at it, you just go, yeah, right, whatever, dude. You took a pen and drew some crap or whoever did. It's just laughable. However, I'm not sure if the triangle really figures into the story as a symbol. What Nathan and I talked about afterward is Nathan thinks there's something called a color triangle, and there's also the idea of the prism, right? And a prism is when you filter light through, and the prism is usually a triangle, you know, like the Pink Floyd symbol that everybody knows, right? And then it kind of blends out into the colors.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this family is getting, they're already fragmented, right? So at the beginning of the story, they're trying to come back together as a family unit. They are trying to heal. Mm-hmm. And then here comes this thing, right, out of space, and it literally starts to splinter them. It takes this unit and literally splinters them. So that would be the symbolic reason I could think of story-wise for the triangle, maybe. But Nathan was also saying something about a color triangle, which I didn't get to research, but that it's supposed to contain all the different colors that we can't even see. So I don't know. That could be part of it, too.
Well, I meant
to research it before we recorded and just didn't have time, so
yeah,
I'd ask you.
Go ahead, Mike. Go.
I think I might be wrong, but I think the color triangle might be a thing where, which is like just a blending thing where like you have the three primary colors in the corners and everything sort of bleeds in and blends at different coordinates.
It's the Illuminati symbol.
I mean, one thing I noticed that stuck out to me is just how much the senses played into the symbolism sort of in the story, right? All the little things that they emphasize. Like, the first thing that responds for Nick Cage isn't the color, it's the smell.
Yeah.
And that's a recurring motif, but he's also the only one who can smell it. Tasting. There's the food he makes for dinner. The drinking of the llama milk is another one. For texture,
the tomatoes when he's eating now.
Right, the tomatoes and the peaches.
Yeah.
There was something for touch, and I can't remember what that was.
Oh, that was skin. His skin was all like
Oh, right, his skin was all scaly and stuff. So it wasn't just the you know, is just distorting our reality, and it's through, and it's our senses through which we recognize and interpret our reality. And so sometimes when that gets screwed up, and you know, it's like that's again something that's happening to this family. This, you know, the prism through which they view the world. Since you brought a prism, is being changed.
Yeah,
their world is being changed, and how they perceive the world is being changed.
One thing I also noticed too is how things are not only being changed, perceived, but how things that are supposed to be individual or their own identity are being compressed and brought together. Like the llamas is a little herd are compressed into this horrible monstrosity. The mother and his son, her young son, are turned to one. A number of wild creatures in the woods, the hunter and the sheriff find, are brought in together. And there's a mention of a black hole, how everything's just kind of pulling things into it, you know? How things are just kind of being crushed into, like, these horrible molten matter, and explosions as well. Kind of gives you a sense of how all-consuming and reaching this thing is. As it's kind of, when we see it, it's kind of like this, these reaching tendrils or this kind of tornado. It kind of just shows you this kind of almost like a celestial alien black hole that just pulls things into together or into itself.
Oh, go on. You were continuing.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, all right, so we'll throw up the spoiler alert because we're talking a little more specifics now, but. Spoiler alert is up, so we're going to critique and discuss anything and everything related to the film. Set up the film, at least what we see on screen, not the short story. Basically, there's this family that has moved back to the patriarch's home. They inherited the home from the father, so they moved from the city back to this very rural town in Massachusetts. Basically, it's supposed to be Arkham. In the town, they're planning to build a dam and create a reservoir or not a reservoir, but a new lake maybe. And so that's, you know, the big news of this quote unquote small town. And then one day, and for the family, there's five in the family and a dog. So mother, father, middle son, a young son, and then an older daughter, and they have a dog. And then the mother is recovering or is in remission for a cancer, so she's not doing well. And then they have a squatter that, since they own a lot of property, maybe, you know, 60 acres or something like that, there's a small house that's not really supposed to be there that has been built by a squatter. So, you know, one of those crazy old men in the middle of the woods type of things, but he's harmless and they don't bother with him and let him still live there. And then one day a meteor hits and crashes in their yard. And that's pretty much the setup. Anybody want to add to that?
Right. Well, then after that, isn't that when Stephen King touches it and green shit starts growing on his hand?
Oh, right. Well, that was definitely a ripoff from A Colorado Space when we did the Creature episode.
And the blob is another, you know, the idea of the meteor from space bringing the terrible evil.
Sure, yeah. That's a fair point. So that's pretty much the setup. Anybody want to add? That we do know that the mayor, who's actually a small role, and there was a couple of deleted scenes. It was like a side story of how she's just a typical politician that wants to make money and all this other crap. They pretty much cut most of that out based off of the cut scenes. But either way, she's the one that wants to build the dam and whatever.
And it wasn't spelled out, but I got the impression that the reservoir was supposed to go right there.
They won't sell.
They've been trying to buy the property and Nick Cage won't sell.
Which is why it explains the mayor's hostility to the family when she arrives on the scene, because she's very bitter right off the bat at them. You know, but yeah, I didn't realize there were cut scenes involved in the. Then again, she was, I think she was someone of note, the actress. So it's kind of interesting that so kind of explains why she is given such a minor role, yet.
Yeah, you know. She's actually played Pocahontas, I think, in the animated version of the Disney film, as a matter of fact. So yeah, she's someone of note, that's for sure. All right, so where do we want to continue? Anybody else want to bring anything else up?
Well, I think the little love story that's established right in the beginning is just kind of interesting, because she's down there doing magic, and she's trying to she says two things. Well, first of all, there's some interesting foreshadowing.
Wait, I just for the listeners who haven't watched this, when you say she's doing magic, she's not doing card tricks. She's doing like witchcraft magic, not
witchcraft.
Right, but we must understand that she's not really doing what it is she's doing is she's performing witchcraft like any teenage girl would. It's but we're not actually seeing any supernatural things actually occurring.
That is correct. People,
or,
yes.
or do we?
Right.
Well, I was going to say, is that true?
We don't want anybody to think that this is like she's casting spells like in Dungeons and Dragons or The Hobbit. You know, she's just a girl that's doing Wiccan spells. What, you know, like a Catholic priest.
No, that's a fair distinction.
Right, that's a fair distinction. Now, but I also would point out, you know, that color is an important part of the film, and, you know, she is color-coded. You know, she has, like, that pinkish-purple hair, which does kind of work well to tie her in with the visual motif of the color from outer space that can't be described by the person who wanted to be an artist.
I think another interesting thing is to show that her practice is one thing that separates her in a sense from the rest of her family, because she is kind of at this rebel age where she's, you know, trying to be her own person, and she uses this fate, this kind of beast practices and stuff like that as a way for not only just something to get her or her beliefs, but also as a way of comfort, because when she's doing this ritual, she's trying to protect her mother, hopefully protect her mother from cancer. And this comes back, and when she tries to use it again, where she her practice becomes a much more horrifying and bodily destroying method when she begins carving the symbols into herself.
Sure.
You know, it just shows these places where everyone feels comfortable or anything like that is where it is no longer safe. The mother, the child, for example, Jack finds comfort in her mother's arms, which calls back to when they are then stuck together completely. There is the father and his garden and his hobbies all become distorted. The alpacas, everything becomes distorted and twisted and infected.
Yeah, he's a gentleman farmer. He's a gentleman farmer.
Yeah. Well, to get back,
he's a wannabe General Mubambi.
Real quick, I just got to tell you, I have a very good friend from high school who's kind of obsessed with alpacas. So I was watching this movie. I texted her. I was like, "Hey, I'm watching Color Out of Space. Nick Cage has alpacas." And then after the movie, I was like, "You know what? You shouldn't watch this movie. Just no. Don't watch the movie."
Well, what I was gonna say is that. It's interesting because we see her practicing these spells, and, you know, the hydrologist says to her, Wiccan or Alexandrian, you know, he says, my guess is Alexandrian, and she says something like, you're wrong, but the reality is he's not wrong. And so that is that moment where they actually establish a connection, which is really important. Because she is doing Alexandrian.
What I got was, whether or not he was right or wrong, I think she was just impressed that he knew her hobby or religion or whatever you want to call it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you know, so it was like, you know, if you go on a date with someone and you talk about some obscure film and then they know all about it, that's kind of cool. And it was kind of like that, because not many people know about Wiccan or Alexandrian. And then he starts the topic and she's like shocked that he knows. And so that kind of gives her a little light in her eye that, you know, finds him attractive because of that.
One thing I think is very interesting too, actually, is that Alexandrian is a callback to, I think, to the library that was destroyed, that was burnt down, and the Wiccan practices, which was another thing, were for a long time were considered taboo and forbidden. So I think there's also a thing of a bit of knowledge of what is considered forbidden or what is no longer attainable. And that's one thing with the Lovecraftian theme is that that kind of, that when these characters try to explore these sort of old texts and knowledge given to them by other beings, it's something they should not know or it cannot understand. That's what I got from that.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, there's a reason, you know, what, I mean, this wasn't necessarily in the short story or novella or whatever you want to call it that Lush Lovecraft wrote, but there's a reason why Richard Stanley wrote this into the scripts. So, you know, it makes sense what you said, Abe, that obviously it had more of a meaning than just, you know, this is a teenage girl that's trying to experiment with various philosophies or religions or hobbies or whatever you want to call it. It was obviously intentional and to make a point of something.
Because she's messing around with forces she doesn't understand, she brings down the damnation of all humanity onto her farm.
Yeah, that's what you were alluding to, Mike, is that you're saying, when I said, you know, she's just, you know, doing the spells, you said, or is she? Meaning, did it come true and it brought down, it called the alien or meteorite to come to...
That is kind of, yeah, that's kind of what I thought, because, you know, the horse's name is Comet, which is foreshadowing, right?
Yeah.
And also, she says a couple of times, not only in this opening spell, but later on when she's actually practicing and carving things into her body, she says, get me out of here.
Right.
Which, of course, actually does happen, just not in the way that she
wanted.
Yeah.
And in the end, she becomes, you know, she becomes the spokesperson, right, for the thing.
Right.
You know, she becomes, I mean, and we don't know what happens to that place eventually, really, and you get the, you know, it's down there somewhere. You know, it's under the lake. We don't know what really happens to her, but, you know, she becomes one with it. And she's not destroyed by it. She's not murdered by it or mutilated by it like the mother and the brother are. We don't know what happens to the other brother, with the older brother.
Yeah, he gets sucked into the well or something.
Yeah, he's in the well now. But again, by the way, I think that's another great example of, where there's people going, but what did it mean it was in the well? I don't understand why it was in the well, but where just keeping things vague just makes it that much creepier because like, is he now one with the dog? You know, what happens down there?
This movie sucked. They killed the dog
or did it?
They changed the dog.
And it's interesting that you talk about that she becomes one of with it and sort of, quote, gets out of here and gets out of there in a way that she didn't expect. Because Lavinia, from the beginning of this film, now I'm talking about the film, not the story, okay, she is not heard in this family. She really isn't heard, right? Her mother was sick and had cancer, okay? Then... obviously, the youngest child, Jack, there is the mother's favorite, and the mother's very protective.
Mm-hmm.
The son kind of does his own thing and doesn't really care. And then the father is kind of all entangled up in, you know, we're buying alpacas and we're doing this and doing that. So when she is the one who comes for, and then this, of course, we already know that she's not heard, that she's not cared for, that her emotional needs within the structure of this family are not being met. And this is why she is rebellious, and this is probably why she turns to witchcraft in the beginning, because she's frustrated that nobody gives a crap about what she wants. It's all about sick mom and the freaking llamas and all this crap, and nobody's listening to me.
Alpacas.
Alpacas, whatever. So, yes, thank you for correcting me. I knew that was wrong when I said it. But my point is just that she is unique in that the light does not destroy her, or the creature does not destroy her, and she becomes one with it. And for the first time in her life, in this family, she feels heard by something. She feels like something listened to her, which is really interesting, because psychologically, if you look at young girls and young boys too, who grew up in homes where there was massive childhood trauma, where they felt like their emotional needs were not met, the first thing they gravitate toward that attracts them when they're out on their own or when they have an opportunity is something that often looks like it's the road to heaven, but it's the road to hell, actually. You know, it's always something toxic, because it looks beautiful and it looks like it's their perfect thing and it looks like it's their rescue. But in the end, it is the toxic thing. And so I thought that parallel was very interesting. And like I said, that storyline is not in the original Lovecraft tale. And that's why I was so impressed with the script, that he was able to take these threads and build something out of nothing. Really.
Well, a couple of things. There is no daughter. And it's all boys in the short story.
It's all boys and the wife. Yeah.
But also, the thing that's interesting about all what you said, Chrissy, is even though she's quote unquote finally heard, she's the one that wants to get the hell out of there the quickest out of everybody, even though she can't for some reason.
Right.
Yeah, but she does find her place at the end.
Yes.
But not intentionally. I think it's
no. Well, that's that. It's that be careful what you wish for. One of the things I liked about the character, and it's a small thing, the teenage girl into witchcraft is a stock trope, right?
And Pie Wacket and all this other stuff.
Right, okay. I love the fact that they took the stock trope and just tweaked it a little bit by having her prefer bottled water in McDonald's. Right? You know, so she's not like, in other words, the stock trope would be that, but she would also be vegan. Or she'd be in some other trendy stuff, as opposed to...
Or she'd be goth, or you know, whatever. But right. Yeah, she's basically a normal teenage girl that just happens to...
Exactly.
Get the, right.
I also thought it was a little bit weird how her mom, like, tried to slut-shame her for wearing shorts. I was like, what?
Yeah, that was...
she's like, look at how you dress, think about the message you're sending. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
No.
Two things on that, Eric, is that I agree, as if she was an adult, she can dress any way she wants, but as a parent, you know how parents are. I don't want you to dress that way. I don't want you to have an earring. I don't want, you know, all that crap. And everybody's heard that from their parents, and that standard. It's just that she was kind of rude the way she did it, because...
Well,
she,
no. Go ahead, yeah, Phil. Then I'll explain it.
Yeah, continue. Please go, Chrissy. I'm done.
What I was going to say is that we see, okay, the father and the mother have a quiet moment out on the porch in the beginning. And she says, I'm becoming my mother. Now, the father, the Nicolas Cage character, says at a couple of points, I'm not my father. I'm not, because they have this whole discussion where they don't want to become their parents.
Right.
We do get a sense that their parents were abusive as the story unfolds. So when Nicolas Cage starts losing his shit and he starts getting very erratic and he's like, rah, rah, there's a couple of points even toward the end where he grabs Lavinia.
Yeah.
And they're going up to the attic and he says, I'm not my father. I'm not my father. And you're like, okay, I think what that scene, the slut shaming scene, was about was actually to show that this thing was also making her become her mother, the thing that she feared most. That's what I got out of that, because it was very out of character for her. And then when they have the fight with the tomatoes, it's like it's abusive, like where he's biting the tomatoes and she's like, fix the dish. It's like, it's almost like they have crossed over into becoming their parents that they can't stand.
Mm.
That is why I thought that was there, Eric, because the first time I saw the movie, I was with you. I was like, Okay, I'm sorry. What the fuck? Where did that come from? That has nothing to do with anything. Like, right. Okay. But then when I watched it the other night with Nathan, because I had already seen it once and I'd made a few notes, you know, back in the theater, I had made a few notes when I saw it in Providence. And then I started to pick up on him saying, like, I'm not my father. It smells like a cancer ward. It smells like my father and his death and all this. And I was like, Oh, I get it now. I think this is happening to the mother too. Because then, of course, she and Jack become melded together, right? She's very overprotective of Jack, and yeah. He becomes one of her. He's even crying like a baby.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's one thing, too.
Yeah, I think that's the progression there. That's my guess. I could be wrong, but anyway, I'm sorry, Abe. Go ahead.
Oh, I think that also the way that the twisted and the mutated become feral and more violent, because, for example, at first, when the mother and Jack are fused, they're very helpless and they still retain themselves. But eventually, they both become this horrifying creature that is just violent and abusive, screaming at Lavinia and stuff like that, pinning her down. And it kind of
That's right. I forgot. Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
You know, because it kind of shows the abusiveness. You know, because you got Jack being attached to her literally at the hip, and her and the mother pinning down the Lavinia, just screaming, shrieking at her, just drool falling out of the mouth, not doing really anything else but just screaming at her. And you've got the symbol of like a disease and stuff like that, like with the alpacas and the animals found in the woods, and some of these strange growths are very cancer like. You know, you got a sense of theme of disease on this, usually, because it's forest. Mm-hmm. It's urgent forest. It's mostly untouched for the most part. And now we see all these growths and things, just like almost like a disease, like a veins and stuff, like in the vines all grown all over the place. It just shows how this disease of the mind and the body is also kind of being shown on the natural landscape as well, and the water as well. Everything is conflicted with a sickness.
Yeah, and there is also a big thing in this. Water is a huge motif in this. And, you know, I think there are a lot of things and places you could go with it as a symbol. But, you know, it's the whole idea of the reservoir, which is very large.
The well.
And the well is water, but they have the whole thing
about the bottled water that she likes to drink.
And the bottled water, and just before the comet hits, there's a glass of water on the middle son's desk, and it's bouncing around. And there's the whole idea, I mean, water, you know, she's letting the sink run over. But what's interesting about every use of water in this film, if you really look at it, is that it's almost always pervasive or overwhelming, or there's an argument about it. And I kind of connected that to the story in a way that this is a family that has come from this trauma of this mother surviving cancer. The daughter's not heard. The son is out smoking pot all the time. The youngest kid just tries to stay a little baby to get his mother's attention. And the father just fucking turns his head away and ignores everything, taking care of his alpacas, thinking that everything is going to be back to normal with his sex life and his marriage, and doesn't really pay attention. So really what we're looking at here with the symbolism of water is that water symbolizes the emotions. This family is ignoring its normal emotional responses, and instead of healing, they're just ignoring it. What do you do when you dam up all your emotions and you keep them away from you? Eventually what happens is they burst through that dam and they destroy you emotionally. And I really think, I did a lot of thinking about this, because I just, even when I was in Providence watching this, I kept going, water, there's something going on about this water. And that's the association or the explanation that I'd like to give. And like Phil said, the well. You know, there's this whole thing going on, not only about water, Phil, but about vacuous holes. There's this whole motif about, I know, I'm not talking about glory holes, Eric. Don't get excited.
That's something Mike would say, not you, Chris.
Oh, I'm dirtier than all you put together, but empty spaces, you know, the well. where the meteorite sinks into the ground. We even have the basement that is only referenced twice, but still, it opens up out of the floor,
well,
and there's dark holes.
I'm gonna call time out here because I want to talk about something you just said.
Okay, go ahead.
You said that the meteor sinks into the well. What?
Newsflash. Mulan, Fast and the Furious, and the Mutants have all been postponed.
Yeah, big surprise.
New Mutants postponed again!
Again!
being pushed into
Which,
year five!
Again, is why the Looking Forward episode is pointless and we should never do it again.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
The annual woohoo flu is...
No, I apologize, Eric. I did not mean sinks into the well. I meant sinks into the ground.
No. But this is what I want to ask about, because the meteor landed in the one spot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then later, am I understanding correctly that it ends up at the bottom of the well?
I don't know. At least in the short story, it moves into the well.
Yes.
That was my question: is whether it moved itself.
Well, what it is,
they see that it's disappeared from where.
Eric,
ended.
I got an answer for you. What it was, at least it's more explained better in the story, obviously because the narration is the whole story. Basically, this alien is like not just a regular being, but it's an outer being, you know, an interdimensional being. So when it isn't really the meteor. The meteor is just its essence, and then it dissolves. And then the essence moves to the well. So it's really just an essence. It's not a solid.
It's almost like something absorbs into the ground, being become part of the land itself. It's, you know, just almost like, a rotten body, just kind of rotting into the ground, become twisted nutrients to fertilize this new, alien life.
It's like when the boy and the mother merge, their DNA like kind of merges and whatnot. It's like the essence that the meteor represents or is merges with the environment around it. And so in this, at least in the story, its essence moves to the well, and then it comes from the well when it expands, it comes out of the well. The essence, if that makes sense.
Okay. Just real quick, while we're talking about the meteor, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Nicolas Cage is watching himself on TV being interviewed and coming up like a total hack-a-doodle. I really enjoyed that.
And it's the fake news where they say, drunk man.
I know, that was so big. And can you tell us how much you were drinking or something? He's like, I don't know, bourbon. Like,
it was like 2 days ago or something. But it's just a crazy guy. The ticker just says drunk crazy man. You know, and it's like.
And he's all out of it, and his hair's all fucked up, and he's rubbing.
And he's like, "Why
is
somebody give me a comb?"
Right. Well, and I felt sorry for him because he was just saying how it was.
Right.
It sounds like insane. That's why when you see a UFO, you don't want to tell anybody because they'll think you're an idiot. So
piss off the mayor.
yeah, that's true.
This will do hit jobs on you.
Exactly.
Oh, I do like, I really also liked, there were several creepy, like genuinely creepy moments in this film, but I did want to talk a little bit about the business with the phone and the voices, because I found those to be especially creepy when they would call and it would kind of hear like, okay, maybe somebody's talking, but you're not sure. But I think the reason those were very effective is because, honestly, this is stuff we hear on our cell phones or on our phones all the time.
Well, if you ask Brent,
it's very formal. Yeah, but it's familiar. So now he's taken something familiar to the audience and made it into something ominous. So I thought that was really unsettling. I mean, I got a whole list of the stuff that was really creepy in here. Like the way the old guy... toward the end, and it sounded like he was on his tape.
Mm-hmm.
Remember? Because, and it was like slowing down and warping, but it was coming out of his mouth. I mean, that was just so disturbing. Because again, it's something we recognize. At least in our generation, we've all heard tapes do that, you know, where they slow down and go, you know, and it'd scare the hell out of you when you were a kid. Go ahead, Eric. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I also just want to mention that I didn't find either of the sons in this movie particularly compelling. But Lavinia, played by Madeline Author, she seems like a fine young actress. I hope to see her in more stuff. And her eyes are amazing.
Yeah, it really works well with the contact lenses, too. The whole aesthetic and her own features really create this very haunting appearance when she is finally overtaken by this entity.
Yeah, and like her eyes were one of the special effects in this movie.
Well, I'm saying in terms at the end when they use the contact lenses, and she gets the purple glowing from her eyes.
Right.
And the symbols and everything like that. It just creates a, you know, it just really works. You know, it's just her very, her whole, you know, because it's actually one of the favorite things they use in some of the promotional stuff. You know, it's just such a striking shot. Her standing at the well, just smiling all blissfully. It's really creepy, but also just really tragic as well. Because, you know, she's, over the course of the story, she's trying to get out. She's trying to break free from this environment. And she slowly becomes absorbed by it. She becomes absorbed by it, and she slowly just breaks down emotionally and physically into nothing.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, she, out of the three children, she's obviously the most developed. And as a result, we get her perspective more so than the other two children. And she is the typical teenager with angst, but also she loves her family and she wants everything to work out correctly and all that. But, you know, I mean, she's a teenager and she's seeing her mother deteriorate, which is troublesome for any young child person for, you know, to see their parents. Never mind the fact that once this terrible thing happens, there's not much she can do because she sees that the mother is already gone. You know, she almost cuts her finger off. The father's going crazy because of what's going on, and she knows why, because of the creature in the well. And also, being a youngster, there's nowhere for her to go, right? She doesn't have her own money. She probably doesn't have a license, you know, on and on and on. So it's not like she can just pack up and move. Yes.
Phil, I hate to interrupt you, but we're talking about the family dynamic.
Yes.
Nathan just actually popped in and did a thing with the pentagram here that he just wanted to share. Can he pop in and just tell us, and then we can go on?
Yeah, of course.
All right, here.
She's going to make me wear the headset. hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going, Nathan?
It was literally, I was walking past the room, and I heard somebody mention the daughter or the son smoking or something, and it clicked in my head. I realized, having watched it last night with Chrissy, that the five main members of the family all represent an element of the pentagram.
Oh, interesting.
Because the daughter represents spirit. She's doing the rituals and she's connected to the horse, and the horse is a symbol of spirit. The youngest son represents water with the connection to the well. The father actually represents earth because he's connected to the land. The eldest son represents fire because he's walking around smoking. Normally I would think that was air, but I realized the mom represented air because she's constantly complaining about the Wi-Fi. And you know, I actually was sitting there just running the whole movie through my head and went, damn it, each one of them constantly represents their element inside the movie of pentagram. So
cool.
I just realized that while I was walking by. Well, hope you're all doing well.
And when they come together, do they make Captain Planet?
Well, no. When they come together, they apparently make a giant wormhole in space. But I also was left at that end wondering if the daughter died at the end or if she was pulled through the wormhole, because the entire movie she kept asking the spirits to get her out of there. Which left me wondering, did she die or did she get pulled through the wormhole?
Find out. Solar Space 2.
Yes.
Dun, dun.
They found it in an attic written by the original author. No. Okay. All right, guys. Have a good one. Stay safe. Don't get sick, and wash your hands.
All right. Thanks, Nathan.
Nice talking to you. Go to the movies.
Hey, sorry about that. Yeah, I just figured. No. I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought that was fascinating, and I'm like, dude, and he's like, no, you can tell him, and I'm like, looking at his writing and going, no, I can't read this. You could tell him. Plus, it just makes more sense coming from him because he really does know all about that stuff. And I mean, he knows a lot more than I do. He's just really well practiced. So, Phil, you were talking about the daughter and all of that.
I was just trying to say that the story, even though Nicolas Cage is obviously the star and has a large portion of the film, the film is really her film, Lavinia's film. And I think a lot of it is, If we want to be less supernatural in its meaning or metaphysical or any of that other stuff, it's just angst of a young person in the world, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I felt that a lot of it was I didn't feel her story arc was as meaning hidden meanings than simply that she was in a place where she saw these terrible things going on with her family and just being teenage angst, adolescence, whatever, that her story was more that, and that's what the film was symbolizing, was that rather than anything else. That's kind of what I, you know, similar to Pie Wacket, where the girl just felt like alone and all this other stuff, I guess. But I don't know, maybe I'm reading.
Well, there's something else I got from this is that one thing I think Lavinia represents is one common theme and story structure that Lovecraft had done a lot in his stories, like the Strange Case of Charles X Ward, which we had actually covered, meet you and I, Phil, with our co-guest in our book reviews, is Lavinia. One thing that Lovecraft does is usually have two types of characters. There's the narrator who recounts the incident that took place, and the main subject, who, you know, is usually the victim or the person who experiences and is consumed by what happens. And the narrator is usually a survivor, who's somebody who's kind of almost retelling this to the listener, because the structure of most of these Lovecraft stories is in letters or journal entries or just memories and stuff like that. And so in this case here, our subject is Lavinia, and the narrator and the recounter of what has taken place is Ward, the student.
Yeah, okay. Go on.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically he's the one who's left behind to pick up the pieces and recount a strange thing that no one's going to believe him. Yet this presence still remains, whether it's in the water or it's in the stars again. He's the only one who understands what, who knows, who's seen it, who's left behind, and yet he is completely changed and damaged. In fact, when we last see him, he's already grown gray. You actually see gray in
his face. Right.
Yes, that's true. And I will say that too, Abe. The opening of the film, and I recognized it immediately, is the opening of the story.
Oh, yeah, forest and stuff like that.
Yeah, west of Arkham, the hills rise wild, and there are valleys with deep woods that no axe has ever cut. There are dark, narrow glens where the trees slope fantastically, and where thin brooklets trickle without ever having caught the glint of sunlight. Then it cuts to a few paragraphs later, and then it says, when I went into the hills and vales to survey for the new reservoir, they told me the place was evil. They told me this in Arkham, and because that is a very old town full of witch legends, I thought the evil must be something which grandmas had whispered to children through centuries. And so what was interesting about that was the connection to the whole pagan element. Mm-hmm. The old witches, and then because that's the next thing we see is her down by there, you know, down by the water doing her spell. But I was a little bit interested, Abe, in the sense of time, maybe because I think the sense of time in the story is maybe different from what's in the film, because it feels like in the film he's telling it from the past, like he's looking back on it.
Yeah.
But I almost got the sense in the story, and I'd really have to read it again, that there's a – I really have to read this again. So please, listeners, don't hold me to this. But I think it actually is mostly the past, but then it switches to like, okay, it catches up to him in the present. I don't know. Did you read it recently, Phil?
Yeah.
I mean, I just read this like 2 days ago, and I don't know why I can't remember that, but whatever.
I read it about 5 years ago, so, and I was planning to reread it within the past 5 days, but with the coronavirus and me freaking out, I couldn't do anything except...
Oh, yeah, I know. It's really hard to concentrate on anything, honestly.
Especially,
you know, it really is. It is.
Yeah, I can't even read it, so I didn't read it, but I can't remember, but based off of what Abe was talking about, how we just did the Charles Dexter Ward, and we're going to be doing another one coming up, those stories did exactly what you said, which is it eventually catches up to them. Well, you know, it's not all flashback. So it wouldn't surprise me if your first memory of when you look back at rereading the story just 2 days ago, that you think that is the case, because it does make sense, because a lot of his stories do that, where it always catches back up to the present, from Pickman's model to all these stories. So, yeah. Chris, I did want to mention this, too. Did you notice that, like, the last lines of this film, and again, is related to water, right? He says, Ward says, I'm not ever going to drink any of the water that's here in this reservoir, because I know what has touched it, you know? So
yes.
The water has become corrupted, at least in his eyes.
Well, and that's also interesting because, because he says, what touched this place? It was just a color out of space, stuns before our frenzied eyes. Okay, wait a minute. The water that covers this place will be very deep, but even then I will never drink it. And here's what's interesting about that, Phil. Metaphorically, it's almost him, because this experience was so emotional for him. Right now, yeah, there was not much of a love story or an attraction going on between him and Lavinia. There really wasn't. But their bond, you got the sense, was pretty strong. It was like that initial strong bond of passion that you sometimes feel for someone.
I'm guessing she must be 18, right? Because otherwise it would be kind of perverted if he was...
Oh, yeah. Oh, I definitely think she was at least 18, maybe even 19. But the thing was... Emotional, metaphor-wise, with the water, that's almost talking about, this was my first love, and I'm so fucking scarred by it, I'm never going to go there again. So if you were to just take the actual story out of it and go with water as emotion, he will never drink from this emotion again. In other words, he will never fall in love again. He will never become passionate about anything again. He will never move on.
I think it's another thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's completely broken.
He's fucking done. Yeah, he's broken. Yeah.
For the record, the actress was probably 21, 22 when they made the film.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm talking about the character.
So what I was going to say is another thing that water is, I think, from how it's presented, is also the thing of clarity. When we see the water, we can still see. Clear, you know, one thing is the lack of understanding and how everyone's reality is distorted. Beforehand, while things were kind of a mess with the family and what the student in life is just kind of going on his business, he's doing his study, they have some sort of grasp of what's around them in the world. But once the color, this presence comes down and its murkiness gets in the water and everything gets dark and everything like that, no one understands anything anymore. Time doesn't have any meaning. Reality doesn't have any meaning. And by the end of it, Ward can't, you know, he survived it, but everything has been changed forever. And he's just, as you guys have said, he's not the same. He's never going to understand anything again, because now it's just so overwhelming. I mean, the very last moment of him in his encounter with the color is him grasping his mind as he's overwhelmed by these images and these sounds and everything like that. You know, this educated mind is just unable, who thinks he's got an idea what he's getting walking into when he's getting out into the world. It just realizes just so much more that is beyond what his reality is.
Well, right. I mean, he just saw Lavinia dissolve and die, and he saw Nicolas Cage, the father, die, and all these other people die. And then suddenly, 10 minutes, or not 10 minutes, but like 3 minutes later, when he's trying to escape from the color and he runs into the house, they're all back alive because their essence is now part of the essence of the meteor creature. So they are all in the family room, and he has to escape their attacks by running into the basement, right? And that's where he hides out. But again, seeing all these things, whether you see people dissolve, whether you see people come back to life, whether you see all these weird things, is definitely going to change your life in many ways. You know, I mean, if you actually have, you know, the Holy Ghost or see Satan come to you in real life, or you see aliens appear, or zombies actually exist, you would change perspective. I mean, I always use the movie The Signs, where the son of Mel Gibson always says to the daughter of Mel Gibson in that film, this is new, this is going to change everything, because there are now actually aliens and we know they exist. Or, you know, and so, I mean, to know that everything that you thought was real is now not real can make you snap, I think. And I think that's what happened here with this guy. Never mind him being in the middle of the whirlwind when all those terrible things were happening.
Well, also just the very fact he saw, you know, the twisted mother and the child. He saw the tree kill the sheriff. He saw the twisted bodies of dead animals. He saw everything just completely fall apart. Literally, he saw a small pocket of reality just turn into a living hellhole that was beyond his grasp or understanding, or any. And he was powerless to do anything at all. All he could do is try to flee and survive.
Right. It's not like a tornado or an earthquake or even a coronavirus. All those things can be explained because they're part of the natural world. This is can't. This is completely different, and that's why. Yeah, he's not going to be able to make it mentally after this.
Yeah, I think that was really fascinating what you were talking about with the clarity, Abe, too. That was really good point that I didn't even think about. But it just goes to show you, like we always say with every movie, it's what you bring to it. You know, mm-hmm. It's your experience. Half of what you interpret, particularly in these movies where there's a lot going on, a lot of it has to do with your life experience. You know, oh, and there was another fun little Easter egg I wanted to mention. Yeah?
No, please tell me the Easter egg, because I have a big question for you.
Oh, sure. The book that the hydrologist is reading when his car light suddenly turns on when he's out there in the tent, it's The Willows by Algernon Blackwood. Blackwood really had a huge impact on Lovecraft. So I just wanted to mention that. I've actually never read The Willows, so I don't know what it's about, but I'm going to write that down. It's my wish list. Phil, what was your question?
Read The Great God Pan by Arthur Machen. That's even better. That Lovecraft always references.
Oh, really? Okay.
Unbelievable. Oh my God, that story is unbelievable. So, the thing I was going to ask you was, what was the moment in this film that made you suddenly say, oh, this is the best film ever? Because you said that at the beginning, that there was a moment that like changed everything when you were watching the film.
Oh, yeah. It was when the mother was up in the attic.
Which scene? Awesome. The first scene when she became the evil demon, or when she was still in pain and agony?
When she was still in pain and agony.
Okay.
Continue. The creatures were really well done. The makeup was really well done. But it was the way that they made her look like the real, like, Oh, God, how do I explain this? All right, I'm just going to say it out loud. My mother had severe cancer. She was skeletal. She was yellowed. She was disgusting. She literally died in my lap. I watched her die. When I saw this woman's face up in the attic there, when they right before, like when she was still before she became the demon, holy crap, I am not even kidding. It was my mother's face. It was so freaky. I was like, oh my God, I have not seen this image in 30 years, you know, however long it's been since she's been gone, 34 years. It was, I mean, whoever did that makeup knew exactly what they were doing. And I was so impressed by it that I was actually traumatized. And I think big kudos goes to that, because this was not just let's make a scary creature. Somebody, whoever that makeup or creature person was, did their homework, because that is, I mean, that's exactly what it looks like. I don't know what else to say. Like, I just, you know, just that for me makes it the best film ever, because I was like, that somebody really went to great lengths to reflect the trauma of, you know, the death of someone who really is dying of that kind of cancer, and yet it's reflected in this creature. I just thought it was just so well done. I mean, somebody had to really spend a lot of time doing the research on that, and just it took it the extra step for me. It wasn't just let's make a scary monster, you know, was good. So there you have it.
Yep. Makes sense.
And I will come with the opposite viewpoint, which is that the scary monsters in this movie were fucking awesome.
They were.
Yeah. I was not expecting to see an alpaca hydra when I started this movie. What the fuck?
That was awesome. That was awesome. And the way that they only showed you pieces of it, Eric, so there was enough of it left to your imagination that it was like the scariest fucking thing ever.
Right, right.
Like, ever. Because I'm sitting there going, oh my God. Like, what? I can't really see it. But they did that a couple times, like in the trunk of the truck.
Yeah.
There's this thing, and you just see like the, oh God, I just thought I hope that I was not implying that the creature effects were terrible in this. I thought they were awesome. That was my point. I thought they were amazing. They went that extra step. But the reason that the alpaca hydra was scary was because it was realistic. I mean, you could sort of believe that. Because
right.
They kept saying radiation poisoning and stuff, and you're like, oh my God, Chernobyl, oh my God. Like,
who turned on the reactor?
Well, and Abe's comment was dead on. It was very reminiscent of the dogs in The Thing.
Yes. Oh, the whole scene was the Thing vibe when he walks into the barn.
Yeah.
Right, and you exactly. Just know the way it's shot and how it's done, and it's nice when someone can do an homage like that, where it's obvious without just directly mimicking it, directly copying
right.
it,
mm-hmm.
you know, not right. like, say, like they did the Thing homage in It Chapter 2.
Oh, my
right. Where, the, right, where, yeah. where it was much more on the nose. So here, it just, you know, very much evoked the feel and the vibe of this. So this is, hey, by the way, another movie we could throw into our Livestock Horror Film Festival with Isolation. And
right.
Black Sheep.
I wasn't trying to Isolation a little bit. Too.
Yeah. That was awesome. I mean, I also like.
It was yeah. practical effects, too. Mostly practical effects.
Yep.
The behind the scenes showed it as practical effects. But
and then you also had the bodies of, was it the dead deer and the cat and everything else are all
merged together. Yeah.
All merged right. together. That was cool. I also liked the little weird ass mantis.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, that was awesome.
It came back at the end. That yep. came yep. back at the end. That was really cool too.
Well, and one of the conceptual thing, like probably the conceptual thing that gave me the heebie-jeebies the most in this movie was the whole concept of merging with another being.
Yeah,
like mother and son become one physically. It's like, holy fuck! What
even is that? What would that feel like? What would the sensations be? Like, does she see through his eyes because they're combined? Do they see each other's sight? Like, what the fuck is that? That was just amazing. It blew my mind.
Well, and it's got to be. It's a weird thing because, you know, obviously they started out merged together 9 years earlier or so. But, you know, is the child dying? Is the child disappearing? Because there's less and less of him every time.
Well, she says, I think it's the daughter, Lavinia, who says she's absorbing him.
Yeah, yeah.
Like reabsorbing him, which would make sense because symbolically it makes sense because even in when he first gets struck by the color and she's all freaking out, we see that she is very overly protective of him, you know, and there's that scene where she's like, oh, sit with me in the bed, you know, and they're all like, you know, kind of cuddling in a couple more years. That would be a really inappropriate way for your mom to be cuddling you in the bed. Yeah. But yeah. So I kind of got the sense that
unless
maybe
you're on porn tube. So that,
yes. I mean, I kind of got the sense that maybe she was the mother was supposed to be a little unhealthy attached to him for some reason. And so maybe that's why it was reflected when they were merged. Yes. Because he was getting less and less of him and he was crying like a baby too. Like he sounded almost like a newborn.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Also, the dog, I think, Mike, was also homage to the thing as well because it was a husky. But that's just, I guess. Because
it was a husky?
Yeah. There was some looks of the dog early in the film. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a husky.
Anybody else see the dog?
I'm going to look at it right now. And it looks like a husky to me.
I wouldn't put money on it. It did have a husky-ish look to it, but
yeah, okay. I don't think it was a husky though.
It looks like a husky to me. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, but either way,
just the moment when there were two moments I want to mention. One is when he threw the daughter in the attic and locked her in there.
Oh,
you're like, oh, fuck. And then when the mom
he says, go feed your mother.
Go feed your mother. Like, you're like, oh, this isn't going to be good.
It's a husky. I'm telling you.
But anyway, then the one Nick Cage movie that I did appreciate is at the end when he turns to the cop. He's just like, they're not my family. They're not my family. I thought that was well done. Cause at that point, yeah, I can totally see him being in that state of mind.
Right. Well, and technically he was kind of right because every day that they were there, or I should say every hour, because this film is only a few days, they're less and less the people they used to be. The creature's taken over there, you know, and I think he still had some moment of clarity there, even if he was going psycho, like Nicolas Cage usually does in a film. His what he was saying, even if it was crazy talk, it was also true, at least in that clarity that he had there. Yeah, so it was kind of good. So I agree with you. That was a good Nicolas Cage moment, I think.
Yeah.
Let's see what else. Anything else? Anyone?
No, I mean, it's 10 o'clock. It's time to put the alpacas back in the barn.
That's right. You kept on saying that. You're right. It was summer, and it was correct times. You know, 10 o'clock was dark, and 9 o'clock was dark, and 8:30 it was dusk. So it's a typical New England. So even though yes, go on.
Nobody mentioned the pussy named G-Spot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was the funniest thing ever if you're a 16-year-old boy who's stoned or whatever it was.
I know. Well, I gotta
the squatter, he was kind of like an harbinger. kind of, sort of.
He was. But also, I appreciated what they did with his character, actually, because in the story, it's an old crazy man named Ami. Mm-hmm. And no one believes him, or he's the only person who remembers the strange times.
Gotcha.
See, that's what I'm saying. The timing is different. So the fact that in this film, nobody really considers him nuts. They just sort of consider him kind of like, oh, he's, you know, he's a hippie. He does drugs, whatever. It's not like a stigma. Whereas in the story, you kind of get the sense that people think this guy is like off his rocker and crazy.
Well, by the way, it makes sense that the story, he would be considered more crazy and whatnot, because in a lot of Lovecraft stories, white trash people, or what he calls white trash people, he considers like crappy genes.
Yeah.
So that's part of racism there. Yeah. So that makes sense that in the story he was considered insane, while in the movie he was just a hippie. You were going to say something, Eric.
Yeah. By the way, after watching this movie, Dan now wants to go build a house out of junk in the woods and get stoned all the time.
I think that's a great idea. I think we should all do that. Because you know what? The coronavirus is coming, and pretty soon there's going to be nothing anyway, so we might as well all go sit somewhere.
Oh, stop to get it.
You sound like Phil.
Knock on wood. Name Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Okay. All right.
Oh, God.
Anyway, anything else anybody want to bring up?
I think I'm about talked out. I don't...
Same here. All right.
Good.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So, let's, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one. We just released episode 403 last week, in which Dan raps about himself using lyrics that I wrote while I beatbox. Perhaps one of the whitest moments ever recorded. So episode 403, if you want to check that out, the Skancy Podcast, Askancity.
I'm sure it's everybody like rapping for Jesus, Eric.
it's almost as good as rapping for Jesus. Yes.
I just noticed that while having the film on in the background, the attic window was a triangle.
Right. Yeah. It was the triangle with the blind down the middle.
One of the many triangles.
Yeah, exactly. The blind in the middle. Yeah, exactly. All right. Sounds good. Now, Chrissy, you have a online e-magazine going on?
I do, which I still, believe it or not, have not gotten all the way through my inbox yet. But the magazine is called 34 Orchards. You can find out more about it at 34orchard.com. That's the number 34orchard.com. And you can also learn more about me. I write short dark fiction at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. I have not had a whole lot of time to do any blogging or announcements lately because I have been so consumed with this magazine, but I am hoping to get that under control pretty soon. So...
what about your YouTube channel? You plan to do any more of those? You used to do those a lot.
Oh, yeah. This Writing Life. I actually, yeah. Phil, have about 10 more episodes I never released. And they're like 3 years old now, so I might get around to doing those, especially since they're 3 years old. But I used to do this series called This Writing Life, and it's just about living the life of a writer. I'm hoping I'll be able to kind of like... reinstated or, you know, bring it back over time. But right now I have about 10 episodes. I pretty much did that between 2016 and early 2018. And so there's like a lot of episodes of things that went on at that time in my writing career that I didn't post yet. So, but they're in the can, they're done. So I really should release them. I've forgotten almost all about it. So what happens when you have your fingers in too many pies? But anyway, yes. So that's it.
Very good. Mike already mentioned the Weapons World podcast, so nothing there. So I guess since it's already been recording for about 2 hours, we'll do what we've been watching and whatever, I guess, next time. So I guess we'll give our final thoughts on the film. So let's start with you, Mike.
Like I said, I really do enjoy this film. It's a nice psychedelic cosmic horror.
I think the effects are good. I think the direction is really solid. The art design is really good. The performances are good, depending on how you take Nicolas Cage. It's just a high recommend all around. I don't know many horror fans that would not at least like it. It is available relatively cheap on disc. It is also available on demand and digital. So go out there and catch it if you can, even if you have to wait for it to be free. But look, we're all going to be locked up for the next 4 weeks anyway, so why not watch something new?
Yes. I'm looking forward to catching up on a lot of stuff.
All right. For me, it's a solid film. It's good to see Richard Stanley back, showing that he just had producers kind of almost destroy his career, but new producers, i.e. Elijah Wood, is back to bring him back from the dead, and he comes out with a grand slam, a 50-yard touchdown, and a hat trick. It was pretty damn good.
What the fuck are you talking about? You just combined three different sports analogies.
That's right. This guy's Bo Jackson, dude. He can play everything. You're damn right. So that's what Richard Stanley is. He's Bo Jackson. So, it's a real good film. High recommend. Great special effects. Great acting, including Nicolas Cage. And it is a solid horror film, and you'll probably see it on a lot of people's lists by the end of the year. It's a shame that it didn't get a widescreen release instead of just a small release. Not sure why that happens, probably because it's not Blumhouse who has the strength of, marketing with cinemas. But all in all, it's a great film, and folks should see it.
It's a hard film to market, and it's a cosmic horror film, and it is a small studio. So, yeah, it's low budget.
Yeah, it was only $12 million. It was a Blumhouse budget, basically. All right, let's go with Chrissy.
High recommend on this film. I pretty much agree with what everyone said. I don't think there are too many horror fans who will not enjoy it. I think it's well built. I think it's well written. I pretty much don't have anything to add. I mean, it's a high recommend, definitely. Rent it, at least.
All right, very good. Abe?
This was a good, a fun watch. It was well shot. Some really cool effects, both in practical and computer generated. Acting was really good. I even still enjoyed Nicolas Cage as Hammius. It's got a great soundtrack. It's overall a really good, solid horror film. I definitely recommend it. It's available to rent if you want to check it out. And it's definitely one of the stronger releases for this year, and I'm pretty sure by the end of it, it'll at least be my top 20, even if it doesn't reach my top 10.
All right, Eric.
I like this movie. Most of the acting is good. The special effects are fantastic. It's a good Lovecraft feel. It would be nearly perfect movie if it weren't for the full Cage moments, in my opinion. So definitely a recommend.
All right, very good. So once again, this is a 2020 Color Out of Space. The story is spelled the British version of Color, C-O-L-O-U-R, but this film just goes C-O-L-O-R. So,
because we're Americans, damn it.
And that's the correct spelling.
America. It's a Color Out of Space without the U. It's available anywhere you look for film. So it's as Mike said, you can get it on disc, so both the 4K and Blu-ray, DVD, whatever. The VOD is available. I purchased it for $14.99 on iTunes, but you can get it pretty much anywhere. Film does cost to see at the moment, but for such a small, independent production, you should probably support it if you like horror films, because it's definitely worth seeing, and it's a pretty solid film. So with all that stated, I guess, Eric, why don't you leave us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about Color Out of Space. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.